session number 11194, Reel 1.
Chapman, Reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all about your life before the war. You know, what's... I think you... Did you say...
I was in the wine trade, yes.
Yes, you were 30, were you?
I was... Well, yes, I was 35 when I was captured, so I was 34 when the war broke out. And I was district manager of the North Midlands for Sandeman, the port people. I had a very good job then. We were in one of the plum jobs, and we lived in Buxton. In fact, I just bought this house there, and in the throes of moving, and of course the climax came. So just for looking after things, I put my car in Buxton and came back on the Sunday that the war broke out. And on the Monday, I rushed off to volunteer at the local place here in Brighton, up in Queen's Road, the Oddfellows Hall. And I tried to get in the Navy, because I trained as a cadet in the Worcester when I was a kid, and I had qualifications. And, of course, the Navy was full. So after mucking around, I tried to join the Army, and I was too old, they said, you know, they didn't want me then. So I went up to London, went to the Admiralty, I went to the Westminster Dragoons, I went to the Air Force, Royal Marines, and they all accepted me for a commission on the strength of my Worcester training. And I had four boards and four medicals, and the first one sent for me got me, that was the Air Force. And I joined up at the beginning of 40 down at Calshot, the headquarters, and blow me, the first chap I ran into was one of my term in Worcester, Roberts. Anyway, I was there during the Battle of Britain. There wasn't much in the way of equipment. We went to sea in an ordinary motor craft, anything that would move, picking up bodies and buoying aircraft. And then it simmered down a bit. And after the about October time, I went up to Grimsby. Very cold up there all that winter. Poor devils coming down, you know, from the Norway Lark. And then I was posted back to Dover. And coming down from Dover, we'd been briefed by the Navy. We mustn't exceed 20 knots. And we were towed out of the Humber by a steam tug because of the vibration of our engines on the acoustic mines. And as we got off the wash, up went a mine, and thank God we were doing 30 knots instead of 20 knots. We had a little bit more sense. We got over it. We were very badly broken up, and we put into crawled into Ipswich, and we were rebuilt. And 2 weeks later, we came down to Dover.
You would have been air sea rescue.
Air sea rescue, that's right. Yes, so they call them Marine Craft Section High Speed Launches. Anyway. I volunteered for Gibraltar. There was a new base to be opened there, and I was promoted to squadron leader, and I had my 10 days embarkation leave, and I got back to the base and had a drink with the boys, and I was going to bed early. I was going to be up at 5:30 the next morning, so I was going to turn in early, and blow me, this chap in this photograph here, Ruffle, suddenly collapsed, and somebody rushed him to hospital. They said he got a perforated gallbladder. So some clot said I was still there. I said, hang on for 24 hours. I sent a relief. So the next day, Ruffle had been on the long parole. There was a rotor there, four launches. And he'd been on the long job, and I was... So I went to the bottom of the rotor. I just did local stuff. Just got back about 4 o'clock, and a signal came through bearing 098 DGN, 18 miles, I think it was. It was a bearing from Dungeness. So I hadn't got a full crew, thank God, because they'd have been killed. But I left four on the dockside. We had normal 10 crew. And put to sea, got on the position, and there were seven 109s. whizzing around above, and anyway, they disappeared. Then we saw a German rescue launch in the distance, and we carried on. We did a square search, damn near up in the high street at Boulogne, you know, and I could see all the people leaning watching us. So I said to Mike Cox, well, we can't go up any further, we should be up on the beach. So make a bead on the Dungeness Lighthouse. It was late in the evening, and it was about 4 or 5-ish, I suppose, May, and we might pick up some wreckage. The wind and tide are setting that way. Meanwhile, these 7109s had come back, and they, as soon as they realised I wasn't going back to Dover, they knew I hadn't got their chap. I didn't know then. I was looking for a German fighter boy. So they peeled off, and they made three attacks. That's 21 bursts of cannon gun. We were burning from stem to stern. We had about 6,000 gallons of high-octane petrol aboard. You imagine how it went up, wooden boat. Anyway, we were all in the drink, and we were fished out. And my coxswain had been hit in the shoulder. And he said, oh, my God. So I said, go and lie down. And I took over the wheel. It was gone, and the steering had gone. We got this big port turn, and they were just sitting target. Anyway, when they got me out, because I was last out, helping all the blokes out, and they got me on the deck, and the skipper, an awfully nice bloke, he'd been with Blue Funnel, I think, the German had been in the English Merchant Navy. And he gave me a bottle of Hennessy, I remember this now, and he took it off, and I glugged down about a third of it.
What was the bottle of?
Brandy. So I said, where's my coxswain? I said, he's very badly wounded in the shoulder. So he pointed and we went forward, and there he was, hanging onto the rail of this rescue launch with these upraised right arm, and he's back towards the bow. And there was an orderly with a probe thing, and he flipped this out. It was a shell. And then it spun round and hit the water, it exploded. Well, we're lucky, because we were shoulder to shoulder. Anyway, we got ashore, and some horrible little runt came down with a beard, like a miniature of the Laughing Cavalier, he thought. He said, you come to celebrate the victory, the victor and the vanquished. You come to our casino, that's the officer's mess. I said, you clotter, we were unarmed, your shooting's to blaze it. I've lost one man, and one of the ones is going to die. And everybody else except another chap and I were wounded. So, then came the liaison officer, I suppose you call him. He was a Prussian. I don't know if you've ever seen some of the Prussians with shaved hair and the monocle that you see on films. He was a parody of that. He was really ludicrous, you know. And he had his arm had been blown off, the left arm. He got his sleeve tucked up. So we went to, eventually went back to the German air sea rescue base in Boulogne. And there were all these little squirts of reporters from the German newspapers, and they've got a picture of my daughter, who was very blonde then. She said, ah, your daughter, ah, she is very blonde, she's a true alien. Ah, she will go to our stud farm. So I said, who told you that? You know, and they all did the, all clicking their heels and that. So you're the squire class, you go to our stud farm. So meanwhile, this sitting in a partner's desk facing each other was this Prussian liaison bloke, and the skipper was a jolly nice fellow. He spoke perfect English, and he was very upset about this. I mean, they were shooting up rescue launches like that. So they were arguing together, and I was looking at them. And so this German turned around, and he says, you understand German, no? So I said, well, you know, and I recollected my wife and I were going, we'd done the Rhone Valley, and we were going to do the Rhine Valley. So a jeweller friend of my father, who's a German, been here for all his life, he said, all right, Edward, all you want to know, Gamesimir and Doppelbett. So this German said, what German do you know? I said, well, Gamesimir and Doppelbett. So he got up, he rammed his cap on with his one arm, and stormed out, and all these little reporter kids had hysterics. In fact, you're talking to a major like that, you see. So the SE Rescue skipper, he looked at me, and he got a broad grin, and he got on the phone, and he made about half a dozen calls. Every time he got to the point, gave him a duffel bed and slapped his thigh. So then he kicked all these kids out, and we had some black bread and some ersatz coffee made from acorns. It was filthy. And so anyway, kicked them all out. We listened to Henry Hall playing before the news, heard the news, and Night and Day was played. Anyway, we had a cream tea and everything after. He really laid it on for us. Then I was the wireless operator and I, he wasn't wounded, neither were I. We were taken to the Gestapo headquarters. And they put us together on a wire mattress with no overlay on it, on this wire business. And some poor little German, he was terrified. And he sat there with his, sitting on a chair, pointing his gun at us, you know. He was more frightened than we were. And the funny thing was, we stopped for some petrol. And the effect of Churchill's V sign, Victoire, Victoria, German, Sieg. You see, everywhere we went, we saw the dash, dot, 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 or they were doing the V sign. It was incredible psychological thing that was, you know, it was very moving.
Yes, who was doing it?
The kids. They recognised my uniform, you see. They're very, very, very quietly, you know, very surreptitiously, and this little girl in the filling station, she went like that to me. No. Anyway, we went to the Gestapo headquarters, and we were motored down to Holland somewhere. I don't know where it was, and we switched over into another car, went by train up the Rhine. Oh, first class! Oh, gorgeous! And up the Rhine, brilliant moonlight, and it was really terrific. And we got to Frankfurt am Main, and then we got on the a tram there and went down to Oberursel. There was this transit, you've heard of this, haven't you? Transit camp just outside. And the very first person I met was John Casson, who was Fleet Air Arm. He was in my top the last year, my last term in Worcester. Extraordinary thing. And I'll show you a picture in a minute. Anyway, he said, I'm sorry, I haven't got any room in my hot old lad. He said, anyway, it's Peter Butterworth. Got any room, Peter? You know, little Peter, the comedian. So I became very friendly with him. And then they got one or two people who were known there, you know, to make a bit of a song and dance, chaps coming in to try and make them talk. And everywhere was wired up. They nudged us to get outside to talk. Anyway, I was there a few days, and before I went there, I was telling you about the cooler. I was put in the cooler first, before I went down to the camp proper. And Air Sea Rescue, they didn't know, you see, how many engines to your aircraft, all that kind of, they asked me all these damn silly questions about aircraft. And this fellow came in, frightfully pucker, you know, hello, boy, I was up at Oxford, I say, oh, you bloody regulations, you know, all this nonsense. So we got this form, and it's a long form. Well, I didn't know anything. What the hell should I know? Air Sea Rescue, asking me all about air bases and who was your commander and so on. So he went off the fee and he said, well, not intentionally. I mean, I couldn't tell him anything. And then a rather serious little man came in and tried to cajole me, an older man, you know. And then finally a fellow came in, took his pistol out. Oh, he was a bully boy, put his pistol on the table in front of us and started a lot of rigmarole. That didn't work. Oh, so they tried out, they left me for a day. Then a fellow came in with 2 litre bottles of booze. He said, you're in the wine trade, so was I. So he said, I thought we'd have a drink together. So he sat down and polished off these two bottles. And I was in good training then, you know. I'd been with Sandeman. He just slumped underneath the table. So I said, I banged on the door. I said, you better come and catch your colleague, and you better let me out to the loo. I'm bursting. So within an hour, I was out in the cab. That's when I met Casson again. Anyway, from there we went to Warburg. I went to Spangenberg first. That's right. I was in the car in the village amongst all.
Before you tell me about that, yeah. You know, it's very interesting. You would have been in Boulogne and going through occupied Europe.
Oh, it's full of
just when the Germans had advanced into that area.
Yeah, that's another thing I've missed. Mm. Are you on?
Yes.
You'd be amazed. I couldn't believe why they didn't follow up the invasion. Every hedge, we're not going to be any hedges, but every clump of trees, and there were nets and tanks and guns. I couldn't believe it. And there were troops all, you know, surreptitiously, not in en masse, but, you know, the groups of here and there. Oh, God, it was unbelievable. I couldn't understand it. I still don't understand why I didn't invade.
How about the civilian populations that you saw? You know, you have given some indication.
Well, they were terrified, of course, but they were relieved. I mean, the French are more hostile now than they were then, because they realise they let us down, and so they're on their dignity now to be stupid. But they were really very, very kind and friendly. Terrified, of course.
I suppose I'm, you know, putting myself in your position.
Yes.
You know, seeing all this sort of the troops and the military apparatus,
yeah.
It must have made you feel rather fearful, didn't it?
Well, it did. I was wondering when they'd be in Buxton, you know. I mean, that was the way I felt, where my wife was, my wife and daughter. But I just tried to make the best of it. I tried to keep my sanity. I think it was the main thing. I thought, well, I've got the 5-to-1 chance about me coming out, and so I did the best.
You mentioned also the Gestapo. You know, did you have any first-hand contact with them?
Then? Oh, yes,
yes.
Rather. Oh, yes, they are.
How did they treat you, the Gestapo?
Very, very almost cruel, without any physical. You know, they bullied me. But I couldn't tell him anything. I mean, if they tortured me, well, I couldn't tell him anything. I didn't know about anything being done on the coast at Dover. But I had another experience later on. That's when we went to Poland, when we were at Shubin. I was much older than the rest, you see. He said, we called him Dracula. He had a long cape right down to his ear, and he had a cadaverous face, like a skull. And he had a Feldwebel, Oberfeldwebel, like a sergeant major type, standing beside him, a big bully boy. So he said, he pointed at me, and I was on that side. He said, "Come as you here." So I went in, and I felt this sergeant's pistol in my back, you see. And I stood in front of this chap. He said, "Freiwilliger or regular? Are you volunteer or regular?" I said, "Freiwilliger." He said, "Unsinn, nonsense, nonsense." He started to slap my face. And I was carted away because there was always maps and things. I had the most undignified examination with the Gestapo. They put me on a trestle table and looked up my backside and around my jaw and everything, you know. It was horrible, and that was unpleasant. And then another experience of the Gestapo. 50 chaps got away from there, not the biggest go, because I was there too, but 50 chaps got away from there, and we had the abort of the lavatory, this big hole in the ground with a long seat with holes in, you know, no partitions. And they kept the end one for tunnels, a new one, just bang, just open as we arrived there. So they could leave that one free, don't use it. So they used to work down there because all this folk all around, it was like a big room with all these piles. Anyway, they made a tunnel, 50 chaps got out. And they went and shot 50 people in the village just out of hand. Must have had help. But we purposely didn't have anything to do with the Poles. That reason, we didn't involve them in any way at all. They didn't think about it. They went and shot 50 people.
50 Polish people?
50 Polish people. And then they had a Gestapo search. It was the funniest thing in the world. Because I wasn't a bomber, but I was a terror flieger, you know, according to the terror flyer. And because I was in the Air Force uniform, I suppose. Anyway, we shared a box about the size of a tea crate. About 10 of us, our precious possession, on top of the cupboard thing at the back of the bunks there. So I went to get my little few belongings, and a little mouse ran out. So he said, told me to hit it, you see, in German. So I said, no. He said, you can kill women and children, you can't kill a mouse. You know, and he started to get uppish. Fortunately, his senior officer came in. But I'll say this. I don't know whether this will be well received on the tape, but I reckon that the Gestapo that I saw were 80% of what I call racecourse Jews. The Jews, nice Jews, will never have anything to do with that sort of rough breed of bully boys you see on race courses. And the Gestapo, I feel, that kind of people. I'm sure they were at least 40% of the evil Jews. And I've got nothing against you, because, I mean, I was born in Brighton and grew up with my best friends. But that was my impression of them.
But you thought they were actually Jewish?
Oh, they were Jewish origin. I mean, they got those features. I mean, yes. Quite a few of them. At least a third, anyway. It was striking, that one. I just said, you know, being a bit of a psychologist, remarked upon it. Now, the other thing I saw in Poland, it had been a sort of reform school or something like that, a sort of borstel or something. There's a lovely old Georgian type of house on a bank looking over a sawmill. And this sawmill was across the road, quite a long way to the left, short to the right, because the road, branch road, went across. We couldn't see down. It was just beyond that. And it went over a bridge, over a dike for drainage, because it was on the Vistula Valley. And one day we were looking at it, we see right down the far end of the sawmill, could see people working on this dike, obviously cleaning it for the winter. And a couple of days went by, and then suddenly there they were, right, women, Jewish women. So two bully boys, all twice as big as I am, with a cudgel, and on the other end there were thongs. And these two bully boys and about 40 women, and some poor woman, she hopped down to relieve herself, and he started slashing across the face with this whip. So he shouted, "You bloody Nazi bastard!" We were shouting at him, you see. And a chappy who'd been wounded, a rather educated type of German, came up, a student type. He said, "What is loose?" So I said, "Look at that." I said, "God, do you treat animals like that?" But she's a Jewess. So I said, "Look, he's killing," and he did. He beat her brains out. The thongs came off this lash, and he clubbed her to death in front of us. And we were screaming at him. So he turned, "Well, she must have done something to deserve it." You know, just like that, just as casual. Anyway, that was Shubin. Then we came to...
Yes, Yogi, I think I've taken you ahead a bit, because we were talking on the theme of the Gestapo.
Oh, yes.
But would you mind going back to the first camp, the castle?
Oh, yes.
We were taken up to the...
We went to... I was in the camp for Grand Blessé, and the occupants who came into... were from Barth, B-A-R-T-H. You've heard of that camp, haven't you? They were the original, the old Ted Edwards, the first POW, New Zealand POW, and a lot of the old sweats. I've got pictures of them here. they'd been to Bath, and they came back to Spangenberg, and I was put there, and another fellow joined me, and we were in the village for about a week, I suppose, and we were moved up. We spent the night alone in the castle the first night. Then all the lads came in the next day, about 260 of them. And it was right on the top of this hill, you know, I suppose, like what's the other one?
Colditz.
They're all the same, you know. It was a dry moat around it. There was a drawbridge across. Dry moat, about 40 feet across, about 40 feet deep. And three wild boar. God, the smell! And an Aussie tried to get out one day through this. God, his leg was terribly ripped up with these boar. Anyway, that was pretty. Couldn't get out of there. And of course, all the rubbish from the camp too was put down for the pigs to eat, and the smell was awful. And all we had was this little courtyard, just to walk up and down in. And,
how about your accommodation there?
It wasn't bad, actually. They were great big rooms, you know, and we had double bunks, one above the other. They were beds. They weren't the rough wooden ones. Like, it could have been a forestry school before. And the food wasn't too bad, really. The funny thing was that the... it was summer, and the Russians hadn't come in the war, and the Americans were still the protecting power. And the Red Cross came, the American Red Cross, and we said, look, we stink. All we've got is what we stand up in. So the soap was awful. It was made of pine substance. It was slimy. It got your dirt off your skin, but you couldn't wash clothes. It was so slimy. So they arranged to... our stuff to go down to the village to be washed every week. So we just walk about naked while our things were being done for two or three. He soon stopped, of course, because it was put up as an escape. They bought, I don't know if you remember, the bread carts, big things with a wicker lid on and covered in oilskin and a shaft with two arms out. He was just going back, no, you're not old enough to remember this. The bread carts used to come round, and two chaps got in this with a few bits, you know, one vest and a pair of socks. And that were 200 people. It wasn't very much, I can assure you. And halfway down the hill, there were two army orderlies from an army camp down below. They get down, they got out and ran away. Nice weather, they were out about 10 days. Anyway, they came back and they went in the cooler. Up in the castle, which is funny, had enormous hinges. They weighed a ton, and they'd cut off the bottom knob of each hinge and withdrawn it. So you used to swing it round on the padlock, and chaps used to come out and sunbathe, and used to put them back at night. It was so funny. Anyway, these chaps were caught and put in the cooler. And they rumbled this opening the door by this time, and so they hadn't seen what had been going on. And they came down, and there was a potato wagon being backed in across the bridge over the cutting round the edge, and through that gate there. Look in that picture, and there they were. Tipping potatoes out, you see, so we just stood there watching, you know, and trying to pinch the odd spot if we could. And finished that, and Philip got like a huge needle, German, he was prodding underneath and prodding inside. So these two chaps, since you went out, everything got to be searched underneath and inside. So one nudged the other, and they walked round the side of the truck, climbed up on the side, got on the roof, leaned over while this fellow was prodding below, and were driven out for another 10 days. The Germans had been told to look underneath. And do you know, that psychology is German, typical psychology. I've worked a hell of a lot with the Germans since the war. And if they hadn't been told, or instructed in some way. It's extraordinary in that way, in business particularly.